have to say, pretty explosive stack of sources lined up. This material, it starts out with cosmology, you know, searching for the physical center of the universe, but it scales down fast to the atomic level and then takes this really radical turn. It shifts focus completely to define a highly controversial center internal biological sociological.
That's right. And our job today really is to trace that whole intellectual journey. We're moving from that big macro search for some kind of external fixed center to this ultimate conclusion presented in the texts, that the center of human existence is, well, inherently internal, and it's based on biological dimorphism.
Yeah.
And from there, the sources build this incredibly detailed case for what they term genoprimariedad, a female primacy. But then, and this is crucial, they immediately argue that this primary status must come with, like, a strict 50-50 accountability for societal problems, all of them.
Right. So we're essentially looking at a philosophical system that tries to weave together astrophysics, evolution, and gender dynamics into one single overarching theory. Now, given how charged some of the sociological claims are going to get, we really want to be crystal clear up front. Our role here is simply to impartially report on the claims, the arguments, the internal logic presented in these sources. We're not endorsing them. We're not critiquing them ourselves. We're just distilling the ideas for you.
Exactly. It's a challenging task, no doubt. Making some dense logic accessible, translating the key insights, even the really provocative ones, without, you know, getting bogged down in jargon.
Okay, let's dive in. Section one. The search for the center, starting big, cosmos to atom. Let's talk about that traditional historical search first. Historically, finding the center was always like a value judgment, wasn't it? First up, geocentrism. Earth is the center. Why? Because of the supposedly greater quality of its matter.
Mm-hmm. And then that got displaced by heliocentrism. The sun becomes the center. Why the sun? Because of its greater quantity, size, and influence. More impactful, basically. And today, the sort of popular candidate, though still hypothetical, is the great attractor, which the sources point out is, you know, completely inaccessible to us anyway.
What I find fascinating here is the rule the sources seem to pull from this history. They say the universe seems designed to allow for varied centers of reference, meaning the center isn't some fixed absolute point. It shifts depending on your scale, your perspective.
Precisely. And that possibility, that flexibility of multiple centers, that's what allows the sources to make this a really critical pivot.
Okay.
So if we can't find the fixed center out there in the cosmos, where's the most complex working center? And the argument then drops down right down to the atomic level. It suggests the centers of human life must be tied to the most prevalent, the most organizing atoms.
Which brings us to carbonocentrismo.
Right.
Our bodies actually exaggerate the percentage of carbon compared to Earth itself, making carbon the center of biology because, well, it's the atom that can form the biggest, most diverse macromolecules. And this supports the broader idea of biocentrism.
But then, immediately, this idea of a competing center pops up. Silicocentrismo. The sources argue that silicon acts as a kind of polar centroid to carbon, and the evidence they point to, our modern reliance, our total dependency on silicon-based information technology.
Hang on. So are they actually saying that our dependence on silicon, I mean, our entire tech infrastructure was somehow part of the plan, like a hidden center just waiting to sort of push back against carbon-based life?
That's exactly the framing. The sources literally call silicon a hidden, dormant, latent center that awakens. It's like the shift from geocentrism to heliocentrism. They argue silicon conspired silently for us humans to develop to a point where we became so transformative through our carbon bodies that we actually needed its external polarity, its communicative function technology, just for stability. And this whole idea, this tension, it sets the stage for the next big structural requirement they talk about, bipolarity.
Okay, that's a powerful transition. So the cosmic center, inaccessible, atomic centers, competing. So the focus naturally shifts to the highest, most complex expression of a center that we can actually observe, the biological one.
Mm-hmm. And now we enter the realm of what they call dimorphismocentrismo. The argument here is pretty fundamental. Existence itself requires a bipolar centroid. It's like the simplest possible relational basis. And this structure, this bipolarity, it scales up to its highest expression in biological dimorphism, male and female, a key consequence of this structure. It fundamentally disallows absolute singularities. Everything is relational. Everything's subject to, well, uncertainty.
And within that necessary biological dimorphism, the sources then argue, if one pole has to be the ultimate center, the primary one, the most primary element, the yin principle, represented by the female. This is where that concept of female primacy, genoprimariedad, comes from.
Right. And the justification they provide for this female primacy is rooted strictly in biological asymmetry and reproductive labor. Nature, they argue, magnifies the primacy of the female through matrificality, that intense focus on the mother-child unit. We see evidence for this, they claim, in the huge size difference between the ovum and sperm. And crucially, the male's biological incapacity for uterine gestation, or long-term basic maternal care.
So in this framework, the sources define the female as the maximum expression of the feminine matrix energy. Establishing that fundamental centrality within the complex system is inherently feminine, according to them. Okay, so that's the primacy established. Now we need to explore how that translates into social dynamics and responsibility.
Yes, and this is where the philosophical ideas really hit the sociological ground hard. If the female holds this primary status, the source introduces this concept of the fine fatal feminine, which basically means primacy can't just be a privilege. It must carry the fundamental responsibility for what they call societal fatalism, the world's problems, the bad stuff.
Fatalism, okay.
And here's where they propose a truly provocative axiom. They state that the total sum of badness contributed to the world is split exactly 50-50, 50% women, 50% men. The text claims this idea is culturally really hard to swallow, precisely because of the underlying, often unstated recognition of female primacy. The logic is, if you're the center, you are, by definition, fundamentally responsible for half the system's failures.
Okay, let's just pause on that. 50-50, that is a deeply challenging claim. How do the sources even begin to justify assigning like a numerical value for blame for something as vague as fatalism or badness?
Well, they justify it by linking social fatalism directly to what they describe as specific feminine psychological excesses. Excesses which, they argue, actually drive massive societal structures. They pinpoint three key ones.
Okay, like what?
First, mitomania. They define this as compulsive lying or maybe self-deception, often used, they say, to resist accepting causal inference, cause and effect or personal responsibility. Second, they argue two huge social structures are rooted entirely in female selection strategies. There's hybristophilia, which is defined as the desire for the strong, powerful, maybe even dangerous man. This, they posit, is the root of the state. And hypergamia, the desire for the richer, higher status man, which they claim is the root of capitalism.
Wow, that puts a completely different spin on phrases like behind every great fortune. It basically reframes our entire economy, our political structures, as sort of necessary outcomes of female reproductive choices, if you follow their logic.
And that selection process is absolutely paramount in their view. The sources critique how we usually view Darwin. They argue his more elaborated proposal wasn't just natural selection broadly. It was much more focused on female selection and male competition, an idea, they say, often conveniently obviated or ignored by critics. And the ultimate goal of all this female selection, ensuring matrifocalidad, securing provision and protection for long-term child-rearing.
Okay, but what about competition within that primary gender? The sources mention competitive sisterhood.
Ah, yes, that's key. The text argues pretty strongly that rivalry between females is intense and consistently underanalyzed, undercriticized. They claim this rivalry drives specific methods of social coercion. For instance, the sources allege women sometimes use false sexual signaling, they call it sexy fakes, to sort of predispose males towards investment or commitment. They also argue women promote puritania, shaming other women, or restricting male sexual access, generally specifically to raise the social price of their own attention relative to their rivals.
And this is crucial. The sources argue that insults we often think of as purely male misogyny, words like puta, zorra, bruja, they claim these are actually creations of interfemale rivalry, weapons used in that competitive sisterhood for social status, rather than originating solely from male resentment.
Which leads us right into the heart of the source's social analysis. How does that primary center, the female pole, translate its biological focus into a kind of social contract? They define matriarchy quite differently than usual, not as direct female political rule, but as a deep psychological and cultural authority. And it's rooted, again, in matrifocalidad, that direct, intense biological relationship with offspring.
So matriarchy isn't about women wearing crowns, but about who holds the kind of cultural veto power, the relational core within the family.
Precisely. And this matrifocal authority, they say, is historically supported by things like lineage tracing through the mother, matrilineality, living near the mother's family, matrilocality, and critically support from other males, brothers, uncles, what they call patrilaterality.
Okay, and then patriarchy, or androkia, as some critics call it, this is presented almost as an ideal, an exchange developed by females.
Yes, that's exactly the argument. The sources frame patriarchy as the social contract, where female primacy, specifically matrifocalidad, is essentially swapped. Swapped for patrilineal protection, the father's lineage, providing security and patriarchal provision living with the father's family for resources. So it's viewed not as some external force that violently supplanted the maternal focus, but as a structure that was developed and maintained by women, primarily seeking material comfort and safety for their children.
And they take that analysis even further, don't they? Suggesting that a lot of modern anti-patriarchal critique is actually, perhaps unconsciously, directed at conservative women. The pious puritanical female, as they put it, who upholds that patriarchal system because it maximizes her own matrifocal privilege. And she uses men as proxies, essentially, to maintain that system against other women who might challenge it.
That's the interpretation offered, yes. And the section wraps up by looking at the shadow side of matrificality, something the sources term overpossessive mothering. Now, this is a highly sensitive claim. The argument is that the intense biological bond of gestation and nursing can create a kind of relational monopoly for the mother, one that's psychologically very difficult to share, even with the father.
Okay, let's try and explain this very carefully because it's a difficult concept presented here. The text seems to suggest this overpossessive mothering is a kind of projection, is that right? Like the mother's intense relational needs from the baby or the baby's overwhelming demands for care. These get unconsciously projected onto her male partner.
Exactly. That's the mechanism described. For instance, the source suggests a mother might use sex or perhaps excessive nurturing behaviors with her partner as a way to unconsciously emulate the intense biological feeling of giving birth or nursing to maintain that sort of relational high.
And the potential risk described in the sources.
The risk, they argue, is this can lead to an intense, almost consuming relational or even sexual fidelity from the child towards the mother, which, they propose, could potentially influence the child's future sexuality, maybe towards homosexuality or asexuality. Or it could cause the father to feel so marginalized, so secondary, that he eventually abandons the relationship due to what they call vicarious shame. It's presented as this fundamental yet largely uncriticized mechanism of relational control originating from the matrifocal center.
Okay, let's move to the final takeaways then.
Right. So at the end of the day, the sources demand we try and embrace what they call a bimorphista perspective. This basically means understanding that all of existence, you know, from the simplest atom right up to the most complex social dynamic, is built on a primary bipolar foundation, male and female, where both genders contribute equally, that strict 50-50 split again, to both the good and the fatalism. And they maintain that refusing to criticize the primary side, the female side, actually prevents any true societal understanding or progress.
So if the ultimate goal is balance, what are the practical applications? What do the sources actually recommend, especially for the male pole, to counter this imbalance? They suggest concrete actions like actively incentivizing patrifocalidad, things like shared custody becoming the norm, fathers consciously taking the lead in domestic tasks, all aimed at creating more relational balance within the family unit.
Mm-hmm. And they also propose something linguistically quite challenging regarding the term machismo. Instead of just trying to eliminate the word, which they see is futile, they suggest re-signifying it, trying to reclaim a positive meaning like pride of being male or maybe machismo as a cultural celebration of form of male energy, and then consciously replacing the negative uses, what they call machismo malo, with more specific, accurate terms like misoginia when that's what's actually meant. This is presented as absolutely necessary to restore a sense of dignity and balance to the male pole in the relationship dynamic.
Which brings us to the really deep challenge presented in these sources, directed squarely at you, the listener. Why, according to this framework, is deep female self-criticism apparently so difficult? The answer, according to the source material, is that the terror lies in confronting what they call the non-divine truth. The truth that her parental selection policy, her choices, is what fundamentally moves the world, for better and for worse. And accepting this, they argue, threatens her perceived primacy, her status, her necessary sense of centrality.
Exactly. The sources basically posit that any real societal progress depends entirely on women finding a way to genuinely assume a 50% responsibility for the world's fatalism, but critically, doing so without sacrificing their necessary self-esteem, their sense of worth. So the challenge they leave you with is this. How often in analyzing problems do you focus only on the secondary partner's faults instead of looking deeply at the demands, the selections, the strategies being set by the primary center?